about analyticity and Green's functions, I learned it from Sergey. So I say this both because I'm grateful, but also because any complaints you might have, you want to direct to him. So we've been insisting in the past few days about off-shell, the importance of looking at off-shell Green's functions rather than just on-shell propagation of free waves. So let me explain why what we mean by that and why we think it's important, okay? And please interrupt me at any time and if I'm not clear or if you want to complain. So suppose that you have a linear equation of motion for some field. I'm going to be super schematic. I'm using scalars. I'm not doing QAD. I'm just using free scalars for the moment, okay? So this is this is in general a differential operator, which depends on time derivatives and spatial derivatives. I'm writing the i's so that when I go to Fourier transform, there's no i's, okay? It's just a choice. And then suppose that I have a source for the field, okay? And let me work in 1 plus 1 for simplicity, because most of the interesting statements are already interesting there, already relevant there. So we all know that for each equation like this, there's a Green's function that tells us the value of the field at t and x as a function of the source at some other time and some other x, okay? And the Green's function, I'm assuming for simplicity that everything lives in a background which is translational invariant, okay? So the Green's function is only a function of the differences. And the Green's function obeys the same equation with this f, but with a delta function source, okay? That's the definition of what we mean by a Green's function, okay? Now, we all like believe that physics is causal, okay? So that for every physical system, there should be a retarded Green's function. So retarded Green's function, which somehow implements the weakest possible form of causality that we are willing to accept, is a Green's function that vanishes at negative time differences here, okay? So that the signal does not show up before the source, okay? So we like to impose this for all physical systems. If a physical system does not obey this, then we call it acausal, okay? Now, this is a classical introduction, but in QFT we have a very similar story, okay? In QFT, I can define the retarded Green function at t and x if I have a field operator phi, interacting field operator, it doesn't need to be free, okay? And in some state alpha, suppose I am in some state alpha, okay? Then, again, hopefully translational invariant so that it's easy. I can go to Fourier transform, et cetera. I can define the Green's function to be just the expectation value of the commutator of field operators. Let me put 0 here. Okay. And we have a very similar equation, okay? And the equation is the following. Suppose you perturb your action or your Hamiltonian by a source for phi, classical source, where by classical I mean that you neglect essentially the back reaction of the field on the source, so you can treat it as an external function, okay? So if you perturb your action by a source term, then the expectation value of phi in the state alpha perturbed by this source is, again, given by an equation like that, dt prime, dx prime, g of x minus x prime, t minus t prime, j of x prime, t prime. This is only true at first order in j, okay? So in general, there are order j square corrections, okay? So this is a perturbative statement in j. So the theory can be arbitrarily interacting in terms of phi, but in j, this is a perturbative statement, okay? But it's true, it follows from the Schwinger-Keldysh representation of the path integral. Okay, so in both cases, we are interested in, and this is G retarded. And in both cases, we are interested in the properties of this retarded Green's function, okay? Again, we want this retarded Green function defined in this way, there should be a theta of t here, to be causal, and it's causal by construction in QFT because there's a theta of t there, okay? But we will see that, for instance, when we want to demand subluminality, we are going to have very non-trivial constraints on the analytic properties of these gr of t. Okay? So the first property that everybody talked about already is that the Fourier transform with respect to time as a function of omega, the Fourier transform is analytic in omega in the upper half plane. And the reason is this. So the retarded Green's function vanishes at smaller at times smaller than zero. So this integral is effectively truncated at zero. Okay? And there's a further assumption here, which is usually implicit, but let's assume it. So we have stability in the form of grt slower than exponential for t going to infinity. So we are assuming that the system is stable, meaning that there's no exponential instabilities, okay? Then if we do have this, which is an assumption, then this integral converges for imaginary part of omega bigger than zero. And the reason is that I times plus I is minus something positive, okay? If this this thing does not blow up for t going to infinity, and t is always positive by assumption, then this integral converges. Not only that, it's analytic. So this is perhaps one of the, so for people who are not familiar with complex analysis, let me just give you a one-line argument of why that's analytic. So there's a theorem that says that a function is analytic if its first derivative exists. Okay? And so, in fact, it's a definition. You can take it as a definition, and then from here, everything else follows about analytic functions, okay? And so we can just check. This is, I can just use the standard rules of derivatives, e to the I omega t, g of x and t, okay? Once again, everything is dominated by the exponential, fall off at complex omega for imaginary part of omega bigger than zero. This is finite. For imaginary part of omega bigger than zero. So it's analytic. G tilde of omega x is analytic. For imaginary part of omega bigger than zero. Okay? Now, if you take a further Fourier transform with respect to x, so just to be super explicit, let me draw two tildes here, okay? So that now I Fourier transformed both variables. So dt dx, et cetera, e to the minus I omega, sorry, e to the plus I omega t minus ipx, gr dx. This turns out, exactly because of the same argument, turns out to be analytic in omega. So as a function of omega is a complex analytic function, analytic omega for real p and the imaginary part of omega bigger than zero. Exactly the same argument, okay? It's an argument about the convergence of these integrals. Sorry, and this is dx dt. Okay? Yes, for simplicity, so that I can go to Fourier transforms. Yes. Otherwise, of course, you have to do everything in a momentum space. Sorry, in real space. Okay? Now, if I want instead, so this was about causality, meaning just the vanishing of a Green's function for t smaller than zero. Now, if I want to impose subluminality, which is a much stronger constraint, then I get a correspondingly stronger constraint in the in Fourier transform. Okay? So subluminality is the statement that gr of tx vanishes outside the light cone. So for x in absolute value bigger than t. Okay? Now you run the same argument. So the double Fourier transform as a function of omega and p as an integral in time truncated at zero Here, this was also truncated at zero simply because of a retarded condition. And then it has an integral in space truncated at minus t and plus t. Okay? E to the plus I omega t minus ipx gr dx. Again, you can study the convergence of this integral, okay? So the boundary, the integral in x is bounded, the integral in t is extended only to positive t's, and what you discover, applying exactly the same arguments, okay, is that now this is an analy- sorry, let me not erase this, let me keep it. So for a subluminal system, gr of omega p is analytic in omega mp for imaginary part of omega, let me get it right, imaginary part of omega bigger than the absolute value of the imaginary part of p. Okay, the absolute value comes from the fact that here I'm integrating x between negative and positive t, and so I have to take care of the signs there. Okay. And now, the crucial fact, at least according to us, is that one really needs to look at the analytic properties of the full off-shell Green's function that I've defined here, meaning as a function of omega and p separately, rather than just looking at analytic properties, for instance, of the on-shell dispersion relation for free waves. Okay? So let me give you two examples that somehow make that explicit. Okay, and the reason is that the retarded Green's function knows about the coupling to sources. Okay, so retarded Green's function knows what a local source is. Okay, whereas free waves in general don't, meaning that there could be field definitions that have the same dispersion relation for free waves. Okay, so they don't change the dispersion relation of free waves, but they change the local coupling to sources in the sense that you go from a local coupling to a non-local coupling. And in fact, Paolo tomorrow will talk about an explicit example of this, I expect, in the Galilean duality, okay? And so our point is that you really need to know, you need to keep track of the off-shell omega p structure rather than using the on-shell condition to rewrite these things just in terms of omega or p. So let me give you two examples. The first is, suppose that my function that defines the equations of motion there, directly in Fourier transform now is a function of omega and p, is what we've been talking about for ENM or QED that Andrew was also using yesterday and Tim was using today, okay? So I have a refractive index, okay? And free electromagnetic waves in a medium obey this, equals zero. And this is indeed a good model. So let's see, why is this a good model? Well, let's think about an action that gives me this equation of motion. Well, an action that gives me the equation of motion is something like, again, for scalars, I have in Fourier transform the omega dp, phi of omega p, let's say phi star, n square of omega, omega square, minus p square, phi of omega p. So what is this? Well, this is non-local in time, in general, if n is a complicated function, but it's local in space. So it comes from integrating out, if you think about it, localized degrees of freedom that don't have long distance propagating modes, okay? They're just localized, so let's say like atoms in a medium. If you neglect the fact that there could be long distance propagating modes, like phonons, for instance, if you neglect the phonons, each atom acts independently of the other atoms as an oscillator for electromagnetic waves that go through, okay? So once you integrate out the vibrational degrees of freedom, let's say, for instance, of an atom or a molecule, you end up with a non-locality in time, but it's local in space, okay? So this is why this is a good model, let's say, for propagation of electromagnetic waves in a medium. Okay? Now, I won't go through the all the details of studying the analytic properties of this, but somehow, given what we have learned right now, let me move this up, sorry. Oh, no, this doesn't move up. Okay. No problem. even what we've learned right now, causality in the form of the vanishing of the Green's function already at t smaller than zero, looking for a choke, in the form of the vanishing of the Green's function at t smaller than zero, imposes a strong constraint on N of omega, okay? So, causality, if you just look at the analytic properties that I just told you, implies that N of omega is analytic, okay, in the upper plane. It's not obvious, but it's reasonable, no? Because I just told you that this thing, so remember that this is what appears in the equation of motion, which I just erased. The Green's function in Fourier transform turns out to be up to prescription for the poles, for instance, if you have poles, turns out to be 1 over f. Okay? And so the analyticity properties of Green's function become analyticity properties of f. You have to be careful about the fact that you are dividing now by 1 over f. So a pole can turn into a zero can turn into a pole. You have to take that into account. But if you do take that into account, the fact that g omega is analytic for imaginary part of omega bigger than zero tells you that n itself, once you take into account all the possible subtleties that you have, turns out to be analytic for imaginary part bigger than zero, okay? Which is actually what we've learned yesterday from Andrew and today from Tim, okay? Now there's the extra assumption, like we heard today, that n omega goes to 1 for omega going to infinity in any complex direction. And this is, for E&M, we believe this assumption because for omega going to infinity, somehow light is propagating in vacuum. It doesn't see the atoms, let's say in a medium. And so you expect this to be true, okay? And then what you find is that, again, you have to run some argument, some contour integrals, et cetera. I won't go through those, okay? But modulo an assumption about the imaginary part of omega, of n, sorry, which is another assumption here. Bigger than zero for real omega. This tells you that your medium absorbs rather than excites, okay? For positive omega, this is obvious. For negative omega, we have to use this parity condition that was discussed today, this morning, okay? Then what you find is that the system is, in fact, subluminal. So the claim is that, and this is one of the standard you can find even on Jackson, no? This is a standard claim in E&M. The claim is that once you have a Green's function associated with an equation of motion like this, the assumption that it is causal, okay, is so strong, I don't know where it is now, here, is so strong, so this is an assumption, okay, but once you assume it, okay, and you have minor technical assumptions about the behavior at infinity and the imaginary part, then you get subluminality, okay, for free. Whereas the story is completely different for another kind of dispersion relation. Sorry, for another kind of equation of motion. Are there questions so far? So suppose I now take this as another example. Okay? So as my equation of motion, I take something like this. So now local in time, but not local in space. And in fact, Andrew had this example yesterday in his talk, no? So he was looking at something that in Fourier transform for the action. Yeah, not necessarily non-local, but could be. For generic F, it could be non-local in space. Yeah, but you're right, not necessarily non-local. So if you have an action like this, in which you have something local in time, standard two derivative, plus a generic function of momenta, then the story is completely different, okay? So the first fact is that here, in the first example, causality was a totally non-trivial assumption in the sense that it had very strong implications for analytic properties of the refractive index. Here, causality is automatic. This is a second-order equation of motion in time, derivatives, okay? We all know that there exists a retarded Green's function. In fact, we can write it down explicitly just by giving a small I epsilon prescription for the poles. This is the prescription for retarded Green's function. It differs from the Feynman prescription because the I epsilon would be outside the square for Feynman, okay? Here it's inside the square, which means that in omega plane, the poles are both below the real axis, as demanded by the analytic property associated with the, which I don't know where it is here, analytic property associated with the causality. So in the upper half plane, it has to be analytic, and indeed, this prescription for the poles has exactly that. So here, causality is automatic, okay? There's nothing to assume, okay? Meaning that for any f you come up with, there exists a retarded Green's function. But then imposing subluminality is a very strong constraint now on f, okay? Which is the opposite of what we had before. Causality was a very strong constraint on n of omega, but then subluminality was automatic, essentially, apart from minor technical conditions. So subluminality as we discovered before, tells us that the Green's function, which now we are saying up to I epsilons, is this, should be analytic whenever the imaginary part of omega is bigger than the absolute value of the imaginary part of P. Okay? This in turn, again, it's not obvious, but it's sort of straightforward to show, that this implies that f itself is analytic for all p's. Complex, okay? So it's analytic in the whole complex plane for p. Again, you can study, I mean, whether dividing by omega squared minus fp squared can create poles, etc. So once you take all that into account, you discover that f of p has to be analytic everywhere. Okay? Then once you know that, you can Fourier transform with respect to omega. So now you end up with a function of time and p. It's a contour integral. You can do it exactly. And you end up with this, minus theta of t. You just use analyticity in P, you use analyticity in P, and the fact that you know explicitly the dependence on omega. So this is an analytic function on omega with a pole wherever P, whenever omega is the square root of f. Okay? And so you discover that the this Green's function as a function of P and time is square root of f time, f is a function of P, over square root of f. Okay, so now there's an extra assumption, which again, it may be true or not, but if you do assume that this function is exponentially bounded in P, in the complex plane, then the sign in the complex plane is essentially an exponential, okay? So this tells you that square root of f cannot grow faster than p, So it tells you that square root of f cannot grow faster than p squared. So at infinity, f of p squared is at most p squared. Okay? But f is an analytic function. So the only is an analytic function everywhere, okay? It doesn't have any non-analyticities apart from infinity. So the only analytic function that is analytic everywhere and grows at most like p squared is a quadratic polynomial. Which is essentially, apart from the linear term, the relativistic equation of motion, okay? C is the mass square, this is the standard P square, and there's a linear term, okay? So that's the only, we claim that that's the only subluminal possibility for an action like this. And so in particular, we disagree with your statement.
In my defense, I made that example of the Lambda before. Yeah, I guess I meant the first drawing.
You mean you have to go to the other representations?
Yeah.
Okay. So you see, so in the first example, causality is super strong, and then superluminality is automatic. Whereas here, causality is automatic, but superluminality is a super strong constraint, okay? And the funny thing is that on shell, if you just forget about sources, sorry, Cedric, I'm going to erase this stuff. Can I erase now? Do not erase. I cannot actually, meaning that I have very little intuition about boundedness at infinity in the complex plane. Yes. So maybe Sergei has
translation in real space by finite amount, right? So it's really assumption that it's a differential operator and not some finite difference operator. Even more than that, so it's, but
no, it's
the temperature. So, sorry, just on the sentence. For example, if there was a P2 before there, what would happen?
Well, you violate it now.
It would be
explode.
That assumption, this exponential bound.
No.
It would violate that assumption. No. P2 to the 4.
Assumption of P2 to the 4 in expression in F.
Yes.
But that's okay. You don't want exponents there, right?
No, what do you mean? Sorry. We proved that. So the only. Meaning sine of P squared is more than.
But I mean that if you have theory omega squared minus P to the 4, it satisfies all our assumptions.
Apart from that one.
Apart from the boundedness, this exponential boundedness. Then for the rest it would be okay. So
because it goes like e to the p square, so it's super.
I would be still subluminal and.
It's not subluminal. But exactly because we know that it's not subluminal because at very large p the speed is arbitrarily large. So, I mean, the only thing that we can say probably is that that's only an effective field theory. So at some point when you really go to very high p's, that's going to be modified.
Sorry, I lost this. Sorry, because I thought you assume subluminality. So then f of p squared is analytic.
Yes.
Okay.
And then it's an extra
the case of p to the 4 is still okay.
Yeah.
What happens? I thought that to rule out p to the 4.
Yes, sorry. You're saying. So p to the 4 is analytic, so it should still be subluminal, the Green's function. Now we are confused.
No, but it needs to be exponentially bounded in the complex p-plane.
Oh, that's, the complex p-plane, but, so that's not, we agree that probably this violates, so p to the fourth would violate this. But
yes.
Subluminality implies this. Now, the question is that, I think that the subtlety is that these are one-way implications, meaning that they are not obviously, the reverse implication is not obviously true, okay? You have to check.
Ah, I see.
Okay, so there is this subtlety.
I see.
This is subtlety.
But this is not a complex distribution, so it can't be compared to the local field.
Because you're saying if it's not exponentially bounded.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's the assumption that gives you the polynomial measurements.
No, but this is not even polynomial, this is exponential.
Yeah, sure. It's
that's exponential, it's not polynomial, no?
Yeah, but it's the same.
It's not the same.
This is the assumption that gives you the tendency.
Yeah, but yesterday you were saying they should be polynomially bounded, which is different than exponentially bounded.
For the S matrix.
For the S matrix.
We're talking outside of your case, but.
Is it?
Yeah, the polynomial boundedness applies to the coefficient of the sign.
So I just go back for a second to Paolo's question. You see that there are only one-way implications because, for instance, here we got that f has to be this, but of course we know that only for a equal 1 or smaller than 1, you propagate inside the line.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So
mm-hmm.
These are strong implications, but somehow, I mean, they cannot be reversed. Okay, but so now we saw that we have a very, so let me call F1 the first example. Let me just rewrite it for you. N squared omega squared minus p squared. And F2 omega squared minus f of p squared. So we saw that we have very different stories for the retarded Green's function for these two equations of motion. Okay, but clearly the two systems, so suppose I have a system described by this and then I have a system described by this, okay, the two systems can have exactly the same free solutions, okay? So the level of free solutions, the free ways, the two systems can be identical, okay? And simply it's a matter of solving this equation. And then suppose I apply the inverse function f to the minus 1. Sorry, I don't want to do that. No, because it's not clear. I don't want to do that. I want to study a specific example. But clearly, I mean, once I rewrite this, I can rewrite this, the solution to this equation as omega as a function of p, okay? Or I can invert that function and rewrite p as a function of omega, in which case I'm kind of solving this equation, okay? So let me give you an explicit example. Which is similar to what Andrew had yesterday. So if I have omega squared as an F2, so of the second kind, minus p to the fourth over p squared plus 1, okay? This is of the second kind, so it's automatically causal. Okay? It's stable because the solutions for real p, the solutions for omega are real. So it's a causal stable system automatically, but it's superluminal. Because it violates, in terms of Green's function, really, meaning that you can propagate really signals between two sources, because it violates this form of F that we derived from subluminality. Okay? This is also exponentially bounded, so it satisfies the assumption about exponential boundedness. Yes?
Sorry, can I ask about the implication again? So are you saying if I have something that has a dispersion relation like k to the fourth, that this thing is not subluminal?
Depends on what you mean by dispersion relation. If you mean that dispersion relation for all shell modes, mm-hmm. I'll never say there is no way. You need to provide more information. You really need to say, well, what is the all shell propagator? How this thing is coupled to the source?
Yes. Well, I guess what he's saying is that, okay, so assume that this is really the off shell propagator with p to the fourth here.
Yeah.
Then I would say that, again, these are one directional implication, so I cannot conclude directly from here, but I would say that, because I'm violating, for instance, this assumption, but I would say that once you have this propagator, you can just check, and I would say that in that case, it is superluminal, right? Because, I mean, even at the level of free solutions, it's superluminal. The very large p, the omega goes like p squared, so group velocity grows like p at very large p, so even at the level of free solutions. So I think that if you really, I mean, the only things that save us is that those are always effective criteria. So at some point, something has to change, no? A very large p. But yeah, that's
but
the claim.
In your case, at large p, it switches to p squared, right?
Well, in this case, yes, exactly. The claim would still be, okay, this is superluminal.
Like formals, I would assume that have similar, I mean, sometimes you have k to the 4 dispersion relation for formals.
Not for formals.
I'm on Bose-Einstein condensate.
Ah, okay, the free Bose-Einstein condensate.
Yeah. So the dispersion relation gets modified at high k.
But the point here is that knowing the dispersion relation is not enough. You can have two systems. Let me keep going with this concrete example. You can have two systems with exactly the same dispersion relation, but they have different causal properties. So you really need to know how you couple to local sources, and you really need to know the off-shell propagator somehow.
Avatar, I have a really trivial question, which is just, you made this statement something about it's possible to have these two forms have the same free solution.
Yeah, let me give you the example.
So, okay, so just so I understand, though, I mean, when you construct the Green's functions, then presumably the only difference between the two is in your boundary conditions.
No, it's the normalization.
Normalization.
Well, you mean in the sense that it could be a non-local renormalization in the sense that I can change.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a function of omega.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks.
It's that. It's that. But somehow, I would say the physical way to understand that is that if you do a non-local change of variables, you're changing the coupling to local sources. So what it looks like a local source in one frame doesn't look like local in the other frame, which is essentially what happens for the Galilean duality, you know?
But so the, can I just ask, because this seemed contentious yesterday, so the dispersion relation in the logic field theory can be superlimited?
The dispersion relation in the, that's a good question. So, in fact, we were talking about it at lunch, I guess. So the, I would say if you have, for instance, second-order equations of motion like in the Galilean, okay, in which there's no difference between group velocity, phase velocity, etc., then all these subtleties are sort of irrelevant, probably, in the sense that...
Just in this example, using p to the four.
Yeah. Well, this is subluminal in the low energy limit, no? So there's a scale here. What saves us usually is that that scale is also the cutoff of the effective theory, so you never get superluminal. Yeah. So this other function that I'm writing down, it looks horrible. It is of the form of the first form, no? N square omega square minus p square, with n square omega given by this combination, 1 over 2 omega square plus omega square root of 4 plus omega square, okay? So there's a branch cut in the upper half plane. And by the way, for n of omega, you have to take the square root of n square. So it's even worse. There's an extra branch cut. Okay? And, but by causality, n of omega was supposed to be analytic in the upper plane. Okay? So this is not a causal system. Meaning that the Green's function, this Green's function does not vanish, cannot be made to vanish at t smaller than zero. There's no retarded Green's function in this system, okay? This, at least, is much better. It's causal and stable. It's superluminal, okay? But at least it's causal and stable. But the claim is that the three solutions are identical, no? Because if I now, is there an eraser? Yeah. If I now well, you can check. No, it's algebra, okay? You can just check that omega square equals this, you plug it in there, and you get exactly zero, okay? And so these are exactly the same free solutions, but very different causal properties at the level of, very different causal properties at the level of coupling to local sources. Excuse me? Normalization of the
quantum perturbations
is not the same, exactly. But so, which is equivalent to saying you have to decide which field operator really couples to local sources, okay? But then this also tells you that you have to be careful to draw conclusions about causality and superluminality just by looking at free solutions. Okay, this is, I would say,
the theory decides.
Well, the theory decides, but if you're not careful, you miss it, no? So for instance, I don't know, as a concrete example, studying QED in curve space and parameterizing everything in terms of N of omega could be tricky because you really have to understand whether that's the kind of the kind of Green's function that you're looking at of the form F1 in our notation or whether it's a more complicated Green's function they should look at. Even though the free solutions are still described by some refractive index as a function of frequency on shell, okay? So the question is, on shell versus off shell, on shell solution versus off shell.
You don't have off shell observables or asymptotically fragile situations? Or do you...
Sergey versus Sergey.
Then also, because we what exactly response to the source.
Right.
And then there's no clockwork.
And there's no upflow
right?
So there'd be nothing further to check.
Well, in that case, yeah. I mean, in that case, what do we mean by causality and superluminality? It's we have to understand.
Well, then there is some positivity conditions amplitudes, right? That's part of the reason why we formulated the paper. Then, because in field theory, commutative vanishes outside time. You don't need to make things even more complicated and go to the amplitude. But exactly to formulate the condition of the amplitude, the motivation was because we had in mind theories where there could be no local operators. And then you can formulate the condition just in terms of scattering amplitudes. And that becomes, in that way, this matrix language becomes a substitute for those other conditions.
But QED in curve space would be in the gravitational theory, you don't expect local.
No, gravity is not dynamical. QED in curve space too has local operators.
In the QED case, I mean, N is perturbative, like 1 plus something which is perturbatively smooth. You work in perturbation theory, so I don't see it's going to make any difference.
Well, you could invert somehow, as Andrew said, you could change a field, you could make a field definition, rewrite everything in terms of NF, which is also perturbative. In general, it won't be either. No, in general, it will be our Fs will be omega squared minus p squared. This is the free case. Plus something perturbative, let's call it G, which is a function of both omega and p. And
yeah,
p. So it's neither of those four.
But that's all about alpha, and you're doing perturbation theory. So.
But you're. So, yeah.
Well, that's my point.
Yeah, but you want to keep track of all other alpha effects.
I don't think there's subtlety that you're talking about.
But aren't you keeping track of order alpha effects? You're doing loops, no? In QED.
You're doing perturbation theory, so in the end, you just have, you know, the free propagators in curved space.
So what are your papers about then? Aren't you computing quantum effects in curved space for QED?
Yeah, but not. But well, that's right. But I don't see why, you know, what you're suggesting here is going to be applicable in a perturbative situation.
I think you're not doing photon loops. Just doing electron loops.
That's right.
Yeah. Still perturbative in that sense.
No, but this is not a non-perturbative effect. No, we are saying that, I mean, it's really a matter of knowing, let's say in perturbation theory, knowing the full off-shell propagator in perturbation theory, rather than just the on-shell, rather than just where the pole of the propagator is. Our point is, it's not enough to look at the pole of the propagator. It's not enough to look at on-shell refractive index, you should really look at the off-shell propagator, even if it's a perturbative propagator, meaning free plus small corrections. And for these questions, I'm not saying that perturbation theory is invalid, I'm saying that for questions as fine as causality and superluminality, that's important. And I don't think the fact that you're looking at perturbative effects make it less important. In fact, at some point, I also think we agreed on this many years ago, or not.
Well, maybe we do.
But if,
we're arguing with different things.
But if you do the field redefinition between the two, if you do it perturbatively, it's just a local redefinition of the source. It's not a big deal.
Let's talk about the scope.
No. No, because it's not like your field definitions. No, your field definitions are form phi of x plus something that depends on phi, for instance. No. So these are could still be linear field definitions, but they depend explicitly on omega and p to go from here to here. So in this case, they are non-local.
But if n is 1 plus
n, yes.
Surely then it's
no, because epsilon is a non-analytic function. In general, is a non-local no, analytic function of p
right.
And omega. So.
Exactly.
So, since here somehow the analytic properties are all there is in this business, it's crucial.
But
here.
I thought analytical was.
Well, if your dispersion relation is, sorry, if your Green's function is of this form and it's causal, but suppose instead it's of this form, then in this particular example, this is already causal. When I go to that representation of the same free equation of motion, this n is crazy non-analytic.
No, I don't quite understand. I mean, I'm working with 2D in curved space. It's a causal theory.
Yes.
So I'm just calculating effects
yeah,
in that theory.
Yes.
To check that, we're saying you need
to check what?
To see explicitly causality and subliminality.
No, QED in curved space, interpretively, is causal.
But what are your papers about? Aren't your papers about causality and superluminality properties of
so it's how to reconcile that with the fact that when in the low energy theory, it looks like you have superluminal mode. And that's what I explained this morning, how you can understand that.
Okay.
And how that's still consistent with the UV theory being causal.
No, but I think we would say that it looked that you have in low energy theory superluminal mode because you were rephrasing everything in terms of n of omega, and then you saw there is something wrong with Kramer-Schrödinger relations.
That
but instead, if you look at the full structure of g of omega p in low energy theory, then also in low energy theory, you would find that there is no superluminality.
Yes. So you're saying if you just take the Drummond-Happing terms and you treat them in the way you're suggesting here, actually, there is no superluminal mode.
Well, I wouldn't phrase it in terms of modes, because our point is that the modes are only part of the story here.
Yeah. Are you suggesting that there's no superluminal issue?
Well, we are suggesting that that's a possibility. We never checked because we were lazy. But I mean, we are suggesting that that's a possibility, meaning that there is this subtlety which somehow disentangles free modes from retarded Green's function. And
also, when you find superluminality in effective field theory, you wouldn't claim that it would be exactly subluminal, but we would claim that the tails which go outside that cone to do coordinate space calculation would
yeah.
be smaller and higher order corrections, which you expect based on power count.
Yeah, that's another layer of complications that somehow is trickier perhaps to address. Yeah.
But that's still saying there is some superluminality in the line effective field theory.
No, it's small.
Yeah, of course it's
small.
Yeah.
So we all agree with that. No. The whole discussion yesterday was, what if you find large superluminality in the limit theory? And when you have theory like p dot squared minus v squared, the pi squared is v larger than 1, no matter how much p is larger than 1, you find large superluminality within an effective field theory because you can just take long time.
But you
can
do that as well in the QED example.
Sorry?
You can do that as well in the QED example. So wait a long time.
No, because the ground is not so translation, right?
It
you can wait, you can build up, then you don't have enough time to build up the effect. So it's crucial for this in that example, it's crucial to have translation invariant background such that even small exit outside light cone you can accumulate it if you want that way.
So
there are many things which are
it's just the fact that it's a black hole background? Enough to stop the motor from accumulating?
Well, because it's a localized thing, right? So it's passive. Yeah. It travels around black hole, you require some time advance, but this time advance for frequencies below the cutoff of the theory is smaller than.
I could imagine there's black hole, but there's stable orbits around the black hole. You can just let it go round and round as long as you want.
That's yes, and you will get it, then you get the fact that in the vicinity of a certain trajectory, you can go faster. then but then there is another trajectory somewhat similar to what in Tim's talk today. So but really include the global structure of the light cone, so that you find it really in the full metric it didn't go space like. Because instead of talking about like going around, let's just take a bunch of black holes, let's say let's do something which quasi-transition environment. Okay. One black hole, another black hole, with another black hole. Well, you send the signal, you accumulate time advance near every black hole. So yeah, it's true, if you go along that path, you accumulate large time advance. But really, when you go close to the black hole, you're slowed down. So it's better when, by the time you build many black holes, they just kind of look for you that you exit out. I said light cone in effective field theory. Now you can send the signal back, like in sidewise, put the mirror there, and send there, and that would be faster. So. We don't have a theorem which covers all these cases, but that's to argue that there is a problem, you need to be very careful. If there is a translation environment background, that even V is smaller than 1, even by a small amount, then you're sure. When there's no translation environment background, it's your task to show that there's actually a problem.
So you say if I asked an asymptotic question, like just asking about phase shifts, there's no problem in that. Or just time delay rather.
No, that's phase shifts at another way. So that's, it's really like gravity. That would be another way, when there is no local observable, that would be another way to impose subluminality. There should be no time advances in phase shifts, quantities of the calculation.
But so if I did that calculation in the QED case, there should be no, you'd say there should be no time delay.
Right.
What am I doing with time?
And you're over.
I'm over, okay. I can stop here.
Okay.
Okay.
Are there any additional questions?
One of your theorems, which I don't know what it is, so, was that causality and the assumption that in the limit the large omega goes to 1, you have subluminarity.
For this kind of equation, for this kind of Green's function.
And is it surprising for the effective theory point of view? In the sense, you would expect some smoothing of the light cone. On the other hand, this is an exact statement. So if asymptotically it's luminous, even in...
Sorry, first of all this is sort of, it's not obvious how to reconcile this with the effective field theory logic. So, for instance, yesterday we also talked about front velocity and stuff like that, which is clearly a concept which is outside the regime of effective field theory. So, it's kind of hard to see how to reconcile this with the statement Sergei was making now, that for effective field theory, respect, again. Now, can I make a comment about that? Okay. So suppose, so in effective field theory, sometimes the degrees of freedom of the low energy theory are not even well defined at high energies. No, we were talking about pions versus quarks, no, in QCD. So there, I would propose to do the same. So I don't have any result about that, but I would propose to do the same. I propose to, for instance, in QED, to talk about interpolating operators like Q bar Q, which have the same in QCD. Sorry, they have the same quantum numbers as the pion. Okay. And always talk about, for instance, correlation functions of these operators, so the retarded Green's function of two O's, okay? In some state, for instance. Then, I mean, effective field theory, so this is a perfectly well-defined correlation function at all energies in QCD, okay? Then effective field theory for pions, so chiral Lagrangian, allows you to compute in perturbation theory certain low-energy properties of these correlators. But these are perfectly well-defined correlators, so somehow, perhaps that's how we should phrase these questions in effective field theory. There should be some exact statements about causality and superluminality. Effective field theory should be interpreted as a way to compute certain correlators approximately. And so, but in this case, perhaps it's not good to talk about the way the light cone as being sort of fuzzy. The light cone is perfectly well defined in terms of interpolating fields, but the pion field is only an approximate tool to compute these things. Period. This is a comment. I don't have any result about this. But perhaps, I guess what I'm saying is that this should be a more precise way to think about superluminality and causality in effective field theory without smoothing out anything. Period.
Any other questions? Okay, so the banquet is sorry.
So in what about the case where it's n of omega squared minus f of p squared?
Yeah, in general, so for instance, in general, you expect, let's say, in perturbation theory in QED, you expect something like this. No? Free plus perturbation, again, you have to study it case by case.
So you don't have generals?
We don't have. Well, the general thing would be, yes, the general thing would be, so again, if GR, apart from pole prescription, is 1 over F, then we know that causality tells you that this analytic function for omega at imaginary part of omega bigger than zero and real P. Subluminality tells you that this analytic function of omega and P at imaginary part of omega bigger than absolute value of imaginary part of P. And if it's not, so if your F is not, doesn't have this property, then you violate either causality or subluminality. Because my original introduction was for generic functions of omega and p, no? And that's it. That's it.
Okay, very good. So the banquet is at 6 p.m. on the second floor. We have lunch, and let's take a look.
Thank you.